So you're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO here in Portland. We are continuing with the second part of the hour, looking at food security and focusing on solutions to the food security dilemma that we face to different degrees based on where we live. And we're going to be speaking with Andy Fisher. He is the founder and executive director of the Community Food Security Coalition down in California. Welcome to you, Andy.
Yeah, thank you for having me on the radio.
My pleasure. I was actually thrilled to find out that you guys even existed when I was doing research for this here show.
Well, great. We've been around since 94.
Yeah, and so tell us a little bit about what the Community Food Security Coalition does.
Sure. We're a national organization. We have about 250 members around the country, a handful of whom are in Portland and a lot more in the Seattle area. Those organizations are kind of at the front lines of building a more sustainable food system. They're doing farmers markets, community gardens, they're anti-hunger coalitions. They're making connections between farmers and consumers. So we act as a hub for them. We do policy work in Washington, D.C., supporting their efforts and trying to bring money back to communities to make those connections between farmers and consumers to address the problems that family farmers are having, to address the obesity crisis and to reduce hunger in this country. So we do policy work. We provide some technical assistance to groups. We do a lot of work right now around getting schools to be buying from local farmers.
Now, I'm curious what you think of as the biggest food security problem that the United States faces, which is going to differ from places such as Niger, which is currently actually in the news with a huge food shortage.
Right. In this country, I mean, it's not the same as in Africa, obviously. There aren't people starving on the streets to the extent that there are in a third world country. So the question is really a question of distribution of resources, whether the poor have enough money to buy the food that they need, and also in terms of access, you know, where supermarkets are located, can people get access to healthy foods? You know, in many communities, there aren't good grocery stores, so people have to rely on corner mom-and-pop stores where they can't get produce. So in this country, it doesn't tend to manifest itself as kind of as blatant hunger as much as it does in other countries. It's a much more subtle issue.
And can you just kind of broadly give us an example of how local communities are addressing food security issues? And I know it's kind of a vague question.
Yeah, that's a vague question. Yeah. I mean, it really, you know, it really depends on the community, and there's lots of stuff going on. Why don't I use the farm to cafeteria angle, because that's something, like I said, we've been doing a lot of.
Okay.
In about 400 school districts around the country, there are programs in which schools have decided to purchase their a portion of their produce or all of their produce or even dairy and meat products from local farmers. So that by doing so, they're doing a lot of different things. One, they're putting more money into the pockets of local farmers. Secondly, they are getting more healthful products and more fresher products and hopefully better tasting products into the school cafeteria, which kids have shown to be more accepting of. So they're, you know, if a carrot tastes good, they're more likely to eat it than if it than it's something frozen or something that's sitting on a truck for a couple weeks. And thirdly, what those projects are doing is that they're building relationships between farmers and the students. When they're incorporated into the school curriculum, they're educating kids about where their food's coming from. They're getting the farmers into the classroom, or they're taking the kids out to the field. So it's a way of building kind of an environmental education and kind of an integrated education that links the classroom and the cafeteria. So kids really understand where their food's coming from. And when they do that, they're more likely to be accepting and to eat it.
Okay, at this point, I'm going to bring our second guest in this part and third overall into the mix. He is Matt Emlin, and he works with the Food Policy Council in Portland's Office of Sustainable Development. Welcome back to our airwaves, Matt.
Good morning.
Now, I'm having you two folks together here because you're kind of working on similar issues, kind of the same issue, different geographic scope. So, Andy, I'm going to talk to Matt here for a moment, and in just a minute or two, we'll kind of get into dialogue amongst all of us, and maybe I'll just even sort of bow out. There is so much stuff going on here in Portland related to relocalizing food, organic food, farmer markets, community gardens. I thought I had a reasonable handle on what was going on, and in looking around to kind of figure out what to talk about with you, I was totally overwhelmed at what was going on here. And why don't you just give us a little snapshot of some of the stuff that's going on, and we can dive into a little bit of it in more detail.
Yeah, I feel the same way. So I've been working with this Food Policy Council, which is a city-county initiative where we've brought together leaders from a number of different perspectives on food, from people like Rachel Bristol working with the food bank to grocers, farmers, people with many different perspectives on food, to look at these questions. I mean, you started the show with this global perspective, and we're trying to figure out what is our local food agenda like? And so how do we work at the local level to build a sustainable regional food economy and support eating fresh local foods and really build it? It's a cultural and economic theme all rolled together here.
Now, can you be just slightly more specific
some of the things
about
we've been
that.
Doing?
Yeah.
Well, one of the areas of interest that came up at council just last month was an urban agricultural inventory. And this is something Commissioner Saltzman's office kicked off last year when there was a project that came through that was a community garden created on a city of Portland property where there's a pump station. And the commissioner said, well, why don't we go out there and look to see if there's other city properties that might be appropriate for community gardens? And our Food Policy Council was saying, yeah, we might even be able to look at some other urban agricultural uses. So there was an inventory that a team from PSU did working with the commissioner's office and the Food Policy Council to look at all the city properties from pump stations or Water Bureau properties or maybe some other under-program sites to see how big a spaces do we have? Might they have water in some way be appropriate for local ag?
That just seems a little surprising given the issue of potentially gutting the Portland Community Garden program that came up in budget talks earlier this year. And they were saved, but to have the city then kind of turn around in a good way for sure and investigate, you know, significantly expanding the community garden system. With just a little curious to me. I mean, it's great if that's really what's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that came out of the budget discussion is that there's huge public support for mm-hmm. community gardens mm-hmm. for a variety of the reasons you've been hearing about. And we must say that some of this inventory isn't being done from the standpoint of, well, we've got a big pot of money to do this. But, right. you know, a key aspect of community development is trying to identify what are the assets out here in the community. And we'll be hearing from different partners who may want to work with us on this.
Well, and it also seems, and I think this is possibly the only aspect of kind of the renewed focus in the kind of cultural language about issues of security. You know, that's one of the things that's really changed in the last 4 years or so. And it's really typically defined as like, you know, the loose term national security, and it really focuses on sort of like military and you know, machine oriented stuff and related to infrastructure, and very little about food. But I think the broader discussion about security has enabled discussion of, well, okay, security. Well, what kind of security? You know, security isn't just national defense. I mean, it's 200 years just about since we were invaded. So that's not really the issue. And, you know, it's like food. That's a security issue. Medical care, that's a security issue. And so it seems like there's openings to really redefine how security is viewed, you know, from the local level up to the national level. Hey, Andy, I'm curious if what Matt's been mentioning here, this sort of trend to relocalize food as a product and different services, is something that you see going on in a serious sense, really across the entire U.S.?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's really local is kind of becoming the next organic.
Why do you think that is? It's great, but it's interesting that it's just kind of poof.
Well, I think there's a couple of reasons. One, I think there's a growing disillusionment with organics in the sense of it's becoming a corporate marketing strategy rather than kind of a real, having those kind of environmental and social connotations that it used to. And I think, secondly, people are hungering for community. They're hungering for a sense of connection between consumer and farmer. Right? I mean, I even hate to use the consumer, between eater and farmer. So they're looking, you know, they're looking to know who produced their food. And they're looking for that kind of that relationship that's totally non-existent in our mainstream food system. You know, you don't, when you go to Safeway or you go to Fred Meyer up in Portland, you don't know who produced your food. It's just a commodity. It's there for sale. But if you go to the farmer's market, you can meet the person who grew it. You can have a conversation with them about how it was grown, where it was grown, even understand a little bit more about farming conditions. If you want to, you can go to their farm. You can go to Salvia Island and go to a Yupik place. So people are, you know, are really looking for that connection that's been gone from their lives in many ways.
I came across I guess the first two editions of what's going to be a twice monthly series in a Canadian newspaper called the Tyee, TheTyee.ca. And they're running a series from a couple who described themselves as almost vegan. And they're doing this really fascinating experiment. They are trying to eat nothing that comes further than 100 miles from where they are. And the first two articles are up, and I'll post links to these articles on the People Rise Up website. But they point out that discrepancy that you just raised, or maybe began to raise, regarding organics kind of being co-opted to an extent. And secondly, that organic doesn't mean local. You know, if you're growing organic food, or want to purchase organic food in part because of the positive environmental impacts compared to the conventional or modern conventional agriculture system, but then it gets shipped 1,000 miles, you're losing and possibly negating entirely the environmental benefits associated with having it being grown organic. And these folks also point out, quoting from part two of their article, "It is increasingly clear that local sustainable eating is not always going to be vegetarian." And that, I thought, is going to upset some folks. Do you see that? Do either of you see that statement as true, that organic is not necessarily better if it's shipped than something that's grown maybe conventionally but is local? And local sustainable eating not always being vegetarian.
You know, we've had some heated discussions with this around the Food Policy Council, and where people really came down was saying that we need to build the market connections that support a base of farmers here, and that's going to let us work on all of the other issues over time. And there will be issues beyond just the organic. So when we started working with Multnomah County on their food purchasing, if you think about it, they buy a lot of food because they feed a lot of prisoners. So we started a pilot project with them last summer where they asked their food service company to start sourcing local where they could across a range of products. So we were able to start with them just saying, let's start tracking the local. Let's try to build those market connections. And I think there are many different aspects of food. And if you look at energy issues like you did today, you need to look at some things just beyond the organic label. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, if you go to Hot Lips Pizza and enjoy the crust there. They are using a grain called Shepherd's Grain that's grown in eastern Oregon using a no-till method. Mm-hmm. And that's conserving water. It's conserving energy. It's not an fully organic practice. But most of us would agree that in terms of preserving soil fertility and saving energy, it's better. In fact, they were able to, the growers of that product were able to get CO2 offset credits. So basically, programs that are trying to reduce greenhouse gas pollution are paying them to use this improved practice. So there's a lot of possibilities out there right now, and I don't think people want to choke it off with just one label like organic right now. They want to start building the market connections that let them pursue a variety of sustainable strategies.
And I would add one other thing. If let's say you're sitting in New York and you have the opportunity to buy carrots that are shipped from California that are grown organically, but they're grown on a 10,000 acre farm by a large corporation and ship 3,000 miles, or you go to the farmer's market and you can buy carrots from somebody who drove 100 miles or 150 miles.
Yeah, like upstate New York.
Yeah, from upstate New York or New Jersey or where have you. What's more sustainable? And it really, I think it really depends upon how you define sustainable. Certainly there's lots of oil costs and externalities associated with transporting those carrots across the U.S. But, if you're more interested in strictly environmental criteria, then perhaps those carrots shipped from California might be more sustainable. But if you're interested in, the kind of the social aspects of sustainability, such as the size of the farm, who owns it, kind of a community economic development perspective and recycling dollars, then you're going to want to invest your money in those local carrots.
Andrew, I might point out that Oregon is actually a leader in looking at different ways of defining and certifying sustainability.
Yeah, that's something I've noticed. There's lots of different little ways to define it. And
Oregon Tilth was really a leader out there on organics. We have the Food Alliance that certified that wheat product that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. They're looking at a broad range of sustainability perspectives. I'm on the board of a group called Salmon Safe that does a water quality-based certification that actually is now sort of dovetailed with Food Alliance, and that's looking at other things like in-stream conditions or other kinds of inputs that would affect water quality and salmon runs. And so there's really a range of objectives that consumers can be looking at right now.
You're listening to People Rise Up on KBOO in Portland. My guests in this part of the program about food security are just speaking there, Matt Emlin from the Food Policy Council in Portland's Office of Sustainable Development. And joining us by phone is Andy Fisher, the Executive Director of the Community Food Security Coalition. You can find out more about them online at www.foodsecurity.org. And the Food Policy Council has a link on the Office of Sustainable Development website for the City of Portland, and that's www.sustainableportland.org. The People Rise Up website at kboo.fm has links to them and all sorts of other stuff related to this topic. Andy, why don't I ask you a final question here, and then we'll finish up talking to Matt about totally local specific stuff and ways for people to get involved here. I'm curious, I imagine that you see the future of this effort being relocalizing food, if you'll pardon the pun, as only growing up and kind of refining itself and kind of figuring out ways that there can be consistent message that doesn't necessarily work the same in all places. I'm curious what you could suggest for folks who maybe don't want to get a community garden plot and can't get to the farmers markets because they work, et cetera, et cetera. How can folks get involved in promoting food security and promoting more local food sources?
That's a great question. You're absolutely right that local food is on the rise, and I think that that growth is only going to continue to move forward, as you suggest. So I would echo your comments there. So for somebody who doesn't have the time, who's a parent perhaps, and is strapped for time and doesn't feel like they can grow their own food or doesn't have the space or not able to make it to the farmer's market, what can they do? You know, I would suggest a couple of things. When you go shopping, oftentimes stores will post where the food comes from. So kind of get a sense of what's in season and try to buy products that are featured in the supermarket that are locally grown. A lot of times there'll be specials along those lines. And if you can get a sense of what is grown seasonally, so perhaps you're not buying cherries in January that are coming from the Southern Hemisphere, that's one way to do it. You know, certainly you can, there's kind of gradations of local. It doesn't mean you don't have to eat bananas, but it means just becoming more conscious of where and how food is being grown. And that kind of information is available all throughout the Internet as to kind of the regions and seasons of food. Other ways are just to get involved with local institutions if you can. If you can, you know, donate money to organizations. Oregon Food Bank does a lot of great work, for example. Other organizations in the Portland area that are focused on food and nutrition issues and making the connections with farmers. EcoTrust is another one I can plug, as I know it's been a very good group. Those are the two main things I would say.
Okay, well, cool. Thank you very much for participating in our conversation this morning, Andy.
My pleasure. Thank you again.
All right, take care. Bye. And now, Matt, you get the last word here. There's, as I mentioned at the front of this segment, there's tons of stuff going on. It seems like there's a fair amount of it that is, you know, it's geared for folks who can, like, be out on the land or have some sort of policy experience or kind of inside knowledge about the food supply system. What can folks do who are not able or interested in actually physically doing, you know, growing local food or working a farmer's market or something and don't have policy experience and aren't really interested in that necessarily?
Well, one of the things that's fun for us about the food from the position of Office of Sustainable Development is that there are decisions people make every day about food. I mean, we work on green building issues, but people may only remodel or build a home, you know, once every decade or something. You know, they may only insulate their home once if they're working on energy stuff, but this is a decision people are making every day about their food. And so if they're not growing it, as Andy points out, being a consumer who's asking, where does this come from? If you're at the farmer's market, we haven't talked about community supported agriculture. There's a lot of farmers out there, working that model. And I don't know if that's something you discussed with your
it isn't
listeners earlier.
And though we are running short on time, it would make sense to at least kind of describe what it is.
Yeah, basically in that model, farmers have subscribers. We've subscribed, it's my family, for, you know, maybe 10 years or so to a group, and every week they deliver to our home a basket of what they produced that week. And other groups have a model where maybe you go somewhere and pick it up, and there's a community experience around that. Mm-hmm. But the basic idea is you're sort of buying a share of a farm, and so you have a direct relationship to the grower there.
And typically you basically buy a season's worth up front, which mm-hmm. gives the farmer capital to do whatever they need money to do. And now, are those year-round?
Some are, some aren't. Okay. The one we have does a good job even in the middle of winter. And that's an exciting thing about Portland mm-hmm. in this whole food arena is that we're seeing people are extending the season. And we're seeing even our farmers markets, many of them want to extend the season. Hillsdale had a successful experience with that this last winter. Hmm. So I think as we look into the future of Portland, we want to be thinking about how do we become a farmers market friendly city where they can explore all these possibilities.
And I think it's worth noting that there's three farmers markets taking place in town today. There's the Interstate Farmers Market up at Fremont and Interstate as of 3:00. People's Food Co-op has a market year-round Wednesdays beginning at 2 o'clock at one block north of Powell on Southeast 21st. In the park blocks just north of the PSU campus, there is a Wednesday market that goes from 10 till 2. It's basically right behind the Schnitzer Hall. And there's several more farmers markets on Thursdays and Saturdays. And are there any on Mondays?
No, I don't think there's a Monday.
No, I guess Saturday to Wednesday is a long enough
span. You know,
span.
One thing we might point out, too, is that the Portland Market and East Bank that's coming up Thursday night have been working on making the markets available to people who use the Oregon Trail card for food stamps. Mm-hmm. So that's a new possibility this year.
Yeah, and there'll be a link to all these local farmers markets on the People Rise Up website. Just real quickly, it's www.OregonFarmersMarkets.org. Kind of straightforward. Well, Matt, thank you very much for coming in this morning to talk a little bit about some stuff going on in the Portland area. There was no way we could get to everything, so I don't feel disappointed that we didn't. But this is a conversation that we'll continue to have on this and probably other shows on KBOO. So we'll stay in touch and see what's coming up.
Great. Thanks a lot.
Matt Emlin works with the Food Policy Council in Portland's Office of Sustainable Development. And we also had Andy Fisher on from the Community Food Security Coalition. And in the first half of the show, Danielle Murray from the Earth Policy Institute. Contact information for all those folks and connections to many more resources related to today's conversation can be found on the People Rise Up website, kboo.fm. Click on the schedule, Wednesday morning at 10, People Rise Up. And I'll be putting more stuff up there real shortly. There's a bunch up now. If you'd like to contact me, you can send email to kboo@riseup.net or regular mail here at the station, KBOO Radio, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Hi to everyone in Idaho, where this show is now being rebroadcast on Sunday mornings, and thanks to Lee for helping put that together. Next week, I'll be speaking with Bruce Gagnon from the Global Network Against Nuclear Power and Weapons in Space.